Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the show, Financial Intelligence. And this is your host, Stephen Hutchinson, who is also the tax ambassador for the Geniuses Common Movement. And I'd like to offer props to our sponsors. That would be my family channel, Miss Beverly Black, as well as Mr. Bruce George from GeniusIsCommon.com. So check that out. Now, at Financial Intelligence, it is our duty, our obligation, our responsibility to help increase the financial intelligence of our community. So we are here to do that. And in order to do that, what we usually do is invite some dynamic personalities, dynamic guests who are engaged in the realm of business, finance, asset acquisition, all the different aspects of finances, because we realize that whether or not you have a business personally, or whether or not you are just investing in a business, or whether you're working a job or whatever, it is essential to understand how money works. And that's what financial intelligence is about. Now, today we have an extraordinary guest who has a pretty incredible resume of accomplishment. So I will just give you a brief summary of these, and then I will introduce you to our guest. Now, she has a background in technical writing, editing, software training, course development, program management. And it's one of her accomplishments. In 2015, she took the physics learning management system and she built it from the ground up, built an entire learning management system in 2015. And in 2016, she increased the customer satisfaction rate 87% to 100% in the first quarter of 2016. And let me just give you a brief list of her skills: writing, editing, desktop publishing, computer graphics, website design. You think I'm joking, right? Client management, internet marketing. Is that enough? No. Social networking, small business, financial, operational management. You think I'm joking, right? Is that enough yet? Okay, let me finish this off for you. Marketing, and she is the founder of Urban Book Editor LLC. It is my benefit to introduce you to Miss Michelle Barad. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, Stephen. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. I'm like out of breath after all of that.
Well, and you make me sound so much cooler than I am. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Well, actually, I don't think I've done you justice. And the fact that you are leading, you know, you're leading the queens by example. And this is what we desire and what we need. So my props to you as a queen, and my props to you as an entrepreneur and as a highly skilled person. On top of that, you have so many skills. So, Michelle, would you please do us the kindness of explaining to our people exactly who you are? What's your personal, you know, give us some of your personal history, who you are, where you're from, how did you get into this industry, and then we'll talk about some of your business accomplishments.
Okay. Let's see. So I'm a native of New Orleans. Moved to Atlanta some years ago for college. Attended Agnes Scott College there. Got a good degree in international relations with an emphasis on Latin America and the Caribbean. left there and went to the D.C. area where I started my career with a company that no longer exists, but it was a great company to start up my career because I was able to move from basically an admin position, you know, that ground floor type position, to get into computer graphics. That's when I really got to kind of embrace my inner geek and play around on the computers. And I've had so many opportunities, I can't even describe them all. I've had the opportunity to live in other countries in Central America and came back stateside and started up my career again in New Orleans, you know, again with computer graphics and things of that nature. And I also got into real estate at that time because I have wide and varied interests. And some years ago moved back to the Atlanta area and was working in software as a trainer, doing documentation, client relationship management, and also, again, in real estate there as well. And just recently reloaded to L.A., where I'm really focusing on growing Urban Book Editor.
Interesting, interesting. I see you have you have very diverse interests. So your interests are not just in one particular field, but in a variety of fields. I see that.
Yeah, I have a weird way of thinking about things. All of these things are kind of interrelated, although it's not always evident at the time. You know, when I first started my career, I started in, like I said, it was actually a tech company in the D.C. area, and I was started as an admin, but I had such an interest in the computers and the graphics, I would go and hang out with the graphics folks all the time. And then I would do little things for my direct boss and eventually ended up moving into that direction. And each of my positions, one way or another, has been kind of a natural evolution, but it's not necessarily the way that other people would think about it. I tend to grow positions around me because I am curious by nature. So I may see that there is a void that I need to fill somewhere in the job that I'm doing, and that expands my knowledge because I'll research a topic, figure out a way to do whatever it is that I'm trying to do, and next thing you know, I've kind of expanded my career path a little bit and picked up new knowledge. And so that's the way things have evolved for me.
Yeah, it seems like that you not only have curiosity, which personally I believe is the basis of genius, it's curiosity. People have an intense sense of curiosity, then go beyond the ordinary to understand things. And apparently you definitely do that, because looking at the diversity of the types of skills that you have and your ability to not only to learn them and do them, but actually execute, because, you know, a lot of people could read a book, but to actually do something and execute it successfully, that's quite an accomplishment. And see that you've been able to do that on a number of occasions, like a couple of things that I mentioned that I read from your website. You building this learning management system from the ground up. VISX, is that what it's called?
Well, VISX is the company that I was working for in Atlanta. It's a software company. They do digital signage software. And what happened was we basically recognized that there was a need for our clients to not only have resources of trainers and scheduled training courses. People are used to learning differently now. They go on YouTube and watch, you know, 5 or 10 or 15-minute videos to learn new things and to gather information. So we were looking for a way to give a similar experience to our clients. So the learning management system that we use is actually a third-party software. But what I did was I researched all of these various companies to come up with a solution or a couple of solutions that might work for a relatively small company and not be cost prohibitive, and also not require a lot of maintenance, because, again, in small companies, you can't have to bog people down in a lot of administrative work unnecessarily because, well, everybody wears a lot of hats in a small company already. So I was looking for something simple and easy to use. but that we would be able to build up a library of content that our clients could go to and watch videos on their own if they don't have time to take the classes, or even in between taking classes, they may say, hey, I remember Michelle told me something about, you know, a playlist. Let me go see if I can find the video because I don't have time, or it's, you know, 9 o'clock at night, or, you know, I'm on the West Coast, it's outside office hours on the East Coast, what have you. So that's what I did, and I helped to build that initial library of content. So that was, you know, the videos, putting together webinar content, writing. I also write and edit the training materials and work on the online help. So all of those things kind of go together to create that experience.
Well, that's of interest to me because this seems to be where training is headed, where education is headed, the direction that business is headed. Is learning is taking on a more of a digital platform, and people are able to access information in a digital platform, which kind of bypasses a lot of the traditional ways in which people were educated, which was going to sit down in a classroom for a number of years with a book open and a pen and writing and taking notes. I was wondering if you could speak to that whole process about learning through these new mediums of learning.
Well, yeah, that trend has been going on for a while. So what the internet has done, and this is really one of the things that I'm passionate about, is that the internet has really democratized communication. And it's done it in such a way that everyone can tell their stories and everyone can share their knowledge. And I personally believe that it's through that sharing of stories and sharing of knowledge that we come to understand one another, and that can help to break down barriers that are causing so much fear and anxiety and what we perceive as hate. You know, I believe that this can be used on a variety of levels, both professional and personal, and then certainly global and culturally. So what you're seeing is that same trend in the internet of people watching YouTube videos and so forth, people wanting to get their education in little snippets, if you will. So you have everything from individual users sharing knowledge in blogs, podcasts, you know, short videos and so forth, going to full-fledged learning management systems where, for example, I can offer courses to the writers that I work with or people who are interested in writing through a learning management type system or a video portal or things of that nature. You're also seeing large-scale courses, what they call MOOCs, where they're massive online I think it's massive online communities. I forget what the MOOC stands for, M-O-O-C. Basically, those are huge platforms where people from around the world come together to take classes online. They may interact with chats and Q&As and things like that. And it's usually a series of videos that the instructors have done that you watch the video, you answer questions, take tests, and again, interact with people, and you may have homework associated. There are actual degrees being issued that way from a lot of the colleges and universities now. And then, of course, you have corporate training, which is going the same way, which is what I've been dealing with primarily.
That is, that's quite phenomenal, I believe, because as I was mentioning before, this is a departure from the traditional way of educating oneself. And I kind of even look at it like a hack in a sense. You could speak to that. I mean, you're the geek, not me, right? You got this thing down. But I'm like, you know, so I'm using the word like hack, like I really know about this. I don't really know, but I've heard the words being used, you know, like a hack into a system, like where you can get directly to the meat and to the juice of it all without having to go through all the bureaucracy, the red tape, the applications, the incredibly high cost for education that we are facing as education just as tuition costs just soar through the sky. at this point. You know, you're talking like $60,000 a year at some universities and more. So I was wondering, before we get into specifically into you being the founder of Urban Book Editor LLC, I was just wondering, because this is something that's so fascinating to me about this alternate universe of education, if you could just like speak a little bit more about that and that hack, and you know, the way in which people could actually make great advancement in knowledge and business as an alternative to the traditional route.
Well, yeah, I think this is one of the best things to happen in training. Well, certainly since I've been involved, I've been in training off and on since 1994, I'm going to say, 1995, something like that. So to me, this is one of the best developments that's ever happened in training, in that, again, you can share a lot of information in ways that people are willing and able to digest. For example, I can sit down during a commute. Let's say I have to get the train somewhere, and I can pull up courses on Udemy or Coursera, or and look and see what's available, and I could sit down and learn while I'm on the train. Now, that makes your life a whole lot easier than always having to cut across town to go to a college or university to get those classes. And if you're in a city like Atlanta, which people always think of southern cities as nice, sleepy southern cities, but anybody who's been to Atlanta knows that the traffic is horrendous. And if you have to be anywhere at 6 p.m. for a class, let's say after work, it is virtually impossible, you know, unless you leave at like 4 o'clock. I mean, even when I was teaching things like web design and so forth, I had to be out of my other office by 4 to get downtown to do the 6 o'clock web class, you know, web development class. So, yeah, it's very challenging. So just from a time perspective, think about how much time you spend in your car. It saves you time there. It also can save real money, real live money. You can go onto sites like Coursera, and that's one of my favorites. That's why I mention it a lot. I take courses on Coursera. Coursera, yes, sir. It's Coursera. .com, I believe. And Coursera has all kinds of classes offered by some of the finest colleges and universities around the world, not just here in the U.S., but around the world.
Oh,
so,
interesting.
Yeah, there are amazing classes being offered. You can take some of them for free, some of them are for a fee. Even the fees for like specializations, you might be able to get a course in, let's say, marketing. And it may be a 5-course specialization that you would take. And each course might cost a certain amount, but it's not going to cost you nearly as much as if you went and took the same course actually at the college campus. So there are a lot of great advantages from a financial standpoint there. There is also a new, and I'm saying new, I think they've been around a little bit longer than I'm thinking, but I just recently heard of an organization that's actually doing online university, and basically it's a free online university. So I don't have that bookmark handy with me, but maybe I'll go ahead and send that to you later when I look it up again. I was just on their website a few days ago, and I was flabbergasted. I was absolutely floored because I've got one kid that went through Boston University. I have another one who's in Washington College right now, and I can attest to the cost of tuition.
And, you're a witness.
Yes, I am a witness. I could definitely testify about the cost of tuition, and it is amazing the thought that you could get a high-quality education for free or really close to free through some of these online universities. So I think there's some serious options out there for people to continue their education and to get their degrees for the first time.
Excellent. That is excellent. Now we're going to, the next thing we're going to get to is your Urban Book Editor LLC. But I just have one more question in relation to the online education. You mentioned another website. You mentioned Udemy, correct?
Yes. Yep.
Yes. So what? Go ahead. Speak about Udemy.
Well, that one is really neat in that you can learn a variety of what I consider that's more skill-based. Some of it is hard skills, some of it is soft skills. Hard skills being things like programming. You may want to learn how to program in Swift, make iOS apps, things of that nature. But you can also get soft skills, which might be client relationship management type skills, or you know, how to talk to your customers, or you know, some language-based skills, more about the softer side of communicating. You can also get courses on meditation. So there are just a huge variety of courses, people from a variety of backgrounds putting these courses up. And I've learned all sorts of things on there. I mean, I tend to be, like I said, a little bit of a tech geek, so I lean toward the programming classes and things like that, the business classes. But there are a wide variety of things for personal development and that you can use in your career. And what's great about Udemy to me is that, you know, once you get on the platform, there's so many courses, but you'll also start getting opportunities to get courses at great discounts. So I've gotten courses that would otherwise have sold for, let's say, $100 for, you know, I've gotten them for $10. So once you get onto these platforms and start getting into their newsletters and receiving their communications, there are some opportunities to learn things that may be of personal interest as well as career interest, but also you can, again, get great savings.
Wow. I mean, I'll tell you, me personally, the that these platforms exist, YouTube exists, Google, the search engine exists, is just, it makes me excited because of the access that one is afforded. It's access, which is absolutely what kept so many people out of the loop in previous decades. People are being kept out of the loop because we didn't have access to the information, didn't have access to the knowledge, have access to the skills, have access to the technical aspects. Now, as you're speaking, because of the digital realm, access is actually available now. And it just makes me so optimistic. And then the other aspect you talked about, well, you talked about two in particular. You talked about the time aspect, and you talked about the financial aspect, you know, and you said you're a witness. You'll stand up and testify about the financial benefits of this, the financial benefits of going through, say, a Udemy or through some of these other platforms where you can access same information, if not sometimes even superior information at such a discounted cost. That is phenomenal because that's oftentimes an obstacle for many of us. It's the cost. So even though we may find an area, you know what I'm saying? We find something that we can access, but the cost is prohibitive. You know, I can't do it. I can't afford it. Then the other aspect is the time. Time is such a valuable, valuable element. It's actually the most valuable element because time spent can never be recuperated. Money spent, we can make some more money with a few maneuvers, proper maneuvers, but we can never get more time. So those two elements right there is just like, please. You know what I'm saying? It's just like,
well, and the time element, and the time element is one that people often overlook. You know, we get used to sitting in traffic. We get used to taking 45 minutes to get across town or an hour to get across town at certain times a day. But when you really add up all that time, and especially as you move up in your career where your time is technically more valuable, right, you really need to think about, well, what is the opportunity cost? What am I losing out on because I'm spending an hour and a half driving to, you know, Emory or Georgia Tech or wherever to take a class? You know, what could I be doing in that time instead? Whether you value that time as time that you would spend with your kids or your significant other or reading a book or anything else, you really have to think about, well, what is that time worth? So I think sometimes we underestimate the value of our time, you know, especially if we live in these cities where we're used to kind of the hustle and bustle. But that is super important, and I think especially for women, because women tend to do double duty even now. And that's, you know, for me, you know, as being divorced, that means I'm 24/7, I'm on, you know. So time is definitely at a premium for me, and I think a lot of people will feel the same way. And once you start taking advantage of these things, you'll see just how much more efficiently you can use your time.
Wow, absolutely. And then that time also, like you said, that we get used to, I mean, practically used to wasting time. We're also used to the fact that, oh, well, it's going to take me 4 years to get a degree, 6 years, 8 years. That's a lot of time if you don't consider alternatives. If there are alternative routes and you can reach that goal in a year, why would you go the four-year route, which takes a whole lot more time, effort, energy, money, and missed opportunity, because you could have already been engaged in your pursuit of your goal as opposed to just being in learning mode for years. You know, oftentimes people, when they become students, they get in the learning mode and there's no application or very little application. What were you going to say, Michelle?
Oh, well, and that's actually one of the things that I was going to get to, is that the difference is you get to immediately try things out. You get to, I mean, yeah, some of the courses are theoretical, some of the courses are, you know, but especially if you're doing things like some of the hard skills I mentioned, like programming, you will actually create a program. You will actually, you know, build a SQL server. You will actually do those things in the course of the class. And once you acquire that knowledge, then you have it. You know, it's not something that you have to keep going through all the theory of to know how to do it. Okay, I have now built a SQL server. I know how to do it. I can build another one. I can do this over and over again. And you can get certificates that show that you can do those things. You can also just build projects and actually put up websites that show your projects. And that becomes your resume. And then you have evidence that you know how to do this thing that you've just learned. And you can then parlay that into internships, into externships, into jobs.
Mm. That is to revenue. I tell you, and that's one of my favorite words, is revenue. My philosophy is revenues is good news. Okay,
that's
a fact. Revenues is good news. Because I think a lot of times when people get all caught up in the whole education thing, oh, yeah, I'm going to get my associate's degree, my bachelor's degree, my master's degree, and this degree. A lot of times I think they're forgetting that probably one of the motivations for what they're doing is to make money, is to generate some revenue. So if you keep the revenue aspect in there, just like you just explained, there are routes, there are alternative routes. I think we are in the 21st century. We have to reboot our thinking when it comes down to education. We need to reboot. We need to delete a lot of the previous programming and, like, download some new software in our minds. You know what I'm saying? Like, download new software. You know, the digital realm is here. The parallel universe exists now, and we don't have to be chained to the old traditional drag your way through the educational system, hoping that at the end of this thing, there's going to be some light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
You know? And that's beautiful. You're showing a great template and a great example of how to actually apply that. And I could see it's from your resume that you've successfully done that in more than one area. You know, you've done it in a number of areas. You know what I'm saying? It's like looking at that resume, most people, if I was thinking in a traditional way, I would have to think that, well, you must have been in school for like 20 years. You know, like, how could you possibly be learning all this? But the fact is that, no, you didn't go to school for 20 years, but you figured out how to hack the system. And that is a beautiful thing. I admire you for that. Definitely.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And your use of the word hack here actually, I think, is apropos because it is kind of a hack. And what we're at a point now with the technology, I believe, is where now we can start rethinking how we want to do or if we want to do college and master's degrees and PhDs. It's not saying that we don't need those things anymore. What it's saying, though, is that people can think about it differently because – life happens. So, for example, for me, when I was in college, my mom got very sick, and it would have been great to have the option to be able to be with her while she was sick and still be able to learn. And some of the things that we have now, if someone's in that situation, folks can still do that. They can say, okay, you know what? I don't have to sit in the classroom, you know, X number of hours a day. I can attend to my loved one and still get an education that's going to produce revenue for me in the end. And they can start creating things and even possibly starting businesses. I tell my kids all the time, I want you to be creators of technology, not just consumers of it. And I think that's really where we need to start moving our kids and ourselves, even, you know, the adults. We need to move ourselves more in the area of creating technology rather than just consuming it. And that's how we're going to win in the future. These are just like foreign languages. You know, as you can see, I'm a big proponent of programming, but this is just like studying a foreign language. The people who study these languages, they are going to be the winners in the future.
Wow, that is a highly energetic way of looking at this, you know, and you have come to conclusions. That's another thing which I admire about you, and it's obvious in order for you to accomplish all these things, you had to be able to make a decision and move on it. Make a decision and move. And I often find that that is one of the greatest problems many of us have. It's not that we don't have the abilities. It's not that we don't have the qualification, but our problem is we don't move on the idea. Once we get a good idea, we need to move on it. And I can see from your resume, you've had a lot of good ideas. But not only have you had good ideas, you have executed on these ideas. You know what I'm saying? You had a good idea, and you've been running with it.
I appreciate that. I've had my fair share of bad ideas as well, and I've run with those too. Those just don't make it to the resume in the same way. But what's most important is to really have an attitude of, well, the time is never going to be perfect. If you sit around and wait for things to be perfect, that's what makes most of us hesitate, right? So the time is never going to be perfect. I have this concept. How can I execute in an incremental way until I can get to a point where I can really push it forward, right? And that is, I think, a better approach than saying, oh, well, I'm going to wait. It's not the right time. It's not this. Yeah, timing is part of it. You know, some things, some ideas come before the market is there, what have you, but if you think about it, really nobody knows what they want until you sell it to them, right? Nobody knows what they need until you show it to them. You know, I think it was Steve Jobs who said that, basically. You got to show people what they need. And so as long as you are making some strides a little bit every day, every couple of days, it doesn't matter if the full-blown vision is there. And I think that's what's intimidating is we see the vision that's really the farther out part, and it's harder to lay out those stepping stones to that vision. But, you know, sometimes you just got to keep looking forward and put one foot in front of the other and step out on faith. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, you try something else. We got to pivot. We can do that. We're smart people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you are definitely an example of that. That's not just the theory. We have models. we have a template. We have an example of the principle, and that's powerful. Now, Michelle, I just want to remind you that as we approach the end of the program, I am going to request you to reveal one or two of your dirty little financial secrets to our listeners. Okay. So if you got one or two, I want you to hold that till the end. Now, during a little financial.
Okay.
Feedback. But now, if you could just tell us about your baby. You are the founder of the Urban Book Editor LLC. Can you give us a feel of that? What is that, and how important is that to you?
So Urban Book Editor LLC came about because the truth of that is I love reading trashy novels. I love it. It's not a dirty financial secret, but it is a dirty little secret of mine. I love trashy novels. And so at one point, I became a volunteer reviewer for a website called the Urban Book Source, which has tons of urban authors producing their work and promoting their work. Really great website. And they were calling for volunteer reviewers, and they would send me these books, and I would sit down and read them, you know, sometimes in one day, because they were so – the stories were amazing and phenomenal. But I found myself after doing several of these that almost every one of my reviews at the end, I was saying, edit, edit, edit. And I think it's because I found it really distracting. And I think this happens to a lot of people. If you're a reader and you're reading, you're into this story, and then the writer uses a word they're not using that word correctly, it's not spelled correctly, there's a typo, there's something, it breaks your, what they call your suspension of belief, particularly if you're dealing with fiction, that suspension of disbelief, it kind of breaks you out of the story. And then you're like, wait, what just happened here? I was in that story, it was great, and now I'm kind of out of it as a reader. And I think that's what was happening to me, and it was becoming extraordinarily frustrating. In fact, there was one book that I was reading it that night, and I said, wait, this is not the right word. And it drove me so insane that I threw it in the car with me the next morning on my way to the office, and as soon as I got to the office, I went on dictionary.com to look up the definition of the word because I was convinced the writer wasn't using it correctly. That's how much it pulled me out of the story. And things like that made me say, you know what, maybe the real issue is that some of our authors are financing their own projects, and they don't have the backing of big publishing companies that have teams of editors to help them with their work. So I will start a company to do this in a more affordable way so that people can break up the payments for that service and produce a higher quality manuscript. So that's how the company came about.
And in the meantime, Ms. Michelle, the entrepreneur, can also generate revenue through that stream. And to me, that is the example of the fundamental principle of entrepreneurship, which I believe is find a problem and solve it. If you could solve a problem, somebody in this universe is going to reach in their pocket or in bank account and give you money if they have that problem and you could solve it. And that's what you did. You saw a problem and you figure out a solution, and you created a company around that. Now, am I in the right neighborhood by thinking like that?
Well, yeah, I think that it was definitely a problem that, especially in 2012, there weren't as many urban editors out there as there are now. So I think particularly at that time, in fact, the genre urban even now is not considered mainstream enough and so forth. So you'll find a lot of small urban publishers and small editing houses that are working with the urban genre. And even when I look for editors to help me when I have overflow work, it's very hard sometimes to get editors to help me if they're from the mainstream side of things because they are not as comfortable sometimes with the grittier street lit that sometimes comes across my desk. So, yeah, it's definitely a need to have people who are willing and able to edit the genre and stay true to the voice of the author. And whether you agree with the content, whether you agree with the characters, you agree with the stories or not, I believe that we all have the right and the need to tell our stories. That's just a basic human need. You can tell from the etchings on the sides of caves where people would draw pictures and tell stories through pictures. That's what the hieroglyphics are. They're telling the stories. That's throughout human history. And so whether you agree with someone's story or not is not the point. Everyone deserves and has a right to and has a need to tell their story in the way that they see fit, and we need to support that, and particularly in our community, because we are not a single African-American community. This is a multitude of communities, and we still need to share our stories amongst ourselves so that we can understand each other and ourselves better and cut down the friction that way amongst ourselves, and that's where this really comes into play with democratizing communication.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. Matter of fact, speaking to that, I've been doing that because just recently I have been studying history, for instance, like the history of the Nation of Islam, right? And
mm-hmm.
Elijah Muhammad and Farad Muhammad and Louis Farrakhan and like this whole thing, Malcolm X, like how the whole thing ever became manifest. Where did it come from? And how did Wallace D. Muhammad, who was actually Elijah Muhammad's son, and
mm-hmm.
it's actually a fascinating story. Again, like you said, it's not about whether or not you agree with what's going on, but it's about communication for the sake of understanding. The better we can understand each other, the better we are for helping each other and assisting each other.
Exactly.
And supporting.
Exactly.
Each other.
Mm-hmm.
So now, but I did want to ask you a question, though, about now you use this term street lit.
Mm-hmm.
At first, this is the first time I've ever heard the term street lit, first thing. So I was thinking to myself, that must mean street literature. Is that what it means?
Yes. So urban, as you know, or maybe folks in the audience don't know, urban is a term that is used to describe, you know, when they say the urban market, that is a term that's used to describe primarily Black and Hispanic or inner city constituents, you know, that folks want to market to. So when they're marketing, when they use the term urban, they're used oftentimes from a marketing perspective. Again, whether you agree with it or not, this is the way the term is often used from a marketing perspective. Urban typically means Black and or Black and Hispanic. Depends on where you are, but that's typically what it means. So
okay.
Urban, of course, also means city dweller, right? A city,
mm-hmm.
an urban area. So for me, what I was really hoping to do was to bring in urban authors who are writing street lit, as in, you know, a lot of these folks are actually incarcerated and they're telling stories that they know from their own lives or inspired by their lives or the lives of people that they know. People who are coming from grittier areas of town than some of us have had experienced, and they're telling oftentimes much more salacious stories than, you know, certainly my suburban lifestyle would support, and so they tend to be a little heavy. So street lit often is a little heavier on violence and sexuality than the mainstream genres. You can, of course, have urban authors, and again, a lot of authors don't care for that term, but that term urban author is often used as kind of a blanket term for Black or Hispanic author, but not all urban authors write street lit, so that's why I make that distinction.
Okay. Now, here's kind of a technical question, but when you're approaching editing, and now,
mm-hmm.
but I would imagine that I haven't read any street lit in a very long time. I used to read
mm-hmm.
Iceberg Slim. I don't know if you ever heard of
yep.
Iceberg Slim.
Yep.
I used to read Donald Goins. Donald Goins. He wrote a number
yep.
of books. I read a number of books of Donald Goins. I read Man Child in a Promised Land by Clark Brown.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of that one? Man Child in a Promised Land?
No, that one, no.
Okay. And I also read Down These Mean Streets by Perry Thomas. You ever Okay.
Okay. Yes, I have heard of that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think that was street lit or urban literature, say in the 70s, early 70s.
Yep.
And I was reading those books. I haven't really read any of those books since then. But what I wanted to ask you about was, when it comes down to editing books like that, usually these books are in the vernacular of the street. It's in street vernacular.
Yes.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be realistic, you know,
mm-hmm.
if it's like street language. So there's going to be, you know, cursing and all that in it. And I'm wondering, how do you edit an urban book, you know, that's in street vernacular? Like, how do you edit such works? What's the premise there for editing?
Okay, so editing is the same, ultimately, for all fiction. And I'm going with fiction just as the blanket here. But for all fiction, it's the same basic concept for me, because I don't want to change the author's voice. I don't want to change the character's voice. So I focus on the story. How's the story flowing? I focus on the grammar and punctuation as far as, you know, the dialogue is concerned. And the only time I fool around with the dialogue is when it's not comprehensible to others, in my opinion. So there is such a thing as overdoing the vernacular spelling. And that's where it gets a little tricky when you're trying to convey, let's say, an accent, or if you're trying to, you know, use very specific, like, for example, out here on the West Coast, where I am right now, they have very specific slang terms out here that we don't use down south. And so if I'm working with an author, I might have to ask, if I can't tell from the context of the dialogue, what is this? What does this mean? They clarify, and then I can say, well, will this work or will it not? And sometimes I have to let them know, well, you know, your audience is not just in California, so they may not understand this term. Just be aware of it. But the bulk of the editing actually takes place with the exposition. It's not really in the dialogue. The dialogue I check, and I look, like I said, for clarity and making sure the punctuation is correct, because even if you're using street vernacular, you still want to have commas in the right place so people know where to pause. You know, you still have to have your quotation marks correct, all of that stuff. But the main thing is in the exposition. That's where we're checking grammar, spelling, punctuation, making sure that everything is in the right order and flowing well, and generally making a good story. That's where that comes from.
Okay. So I can understand that a little better now, because at first I really couldn't
mm-hmm.
understand, like, how you would edit a self-published book that was in street vernacular. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because,
yep.
You know, one would think in editing a person would, you know, try to have, well, you know, it has to be, you know, like the King's English, which obviously is not going to go over in an urban book. You know what I'm saying? It's not going to work. You know what I'm saying? You definitely cannot deliver that scenario with proper grammatical English, because people don't speak like that, you know? So, okay. Now, we do have a couple of listeners, Michelle. Would you mind if I ask a couple of our listeners if they have any questions or comments? Would you mind?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay. Okay. So, my dear listeners, I can only see your number. So, your exchange 209, and I'm going to open up your mic. So, if that's your exchange 209, and if you have a question or a comment for Michelle, your mic is now open, 209. Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Hello? Hello? Yep, can hear you clearly.
Yes.
Yes.
I had
what's your name?
Unmute. My name is Geraldine Hollis.
Okay. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Stockton, California.
Okay. And do you have a comment for Joe?
A comment, mostly. I am I'm still a learner. I really enjoy learning new things and new situations. And I would just like to say to Michelle, thank you for all of the advice that you've given and the ideas. I am a published author, self-published, and still going through some situations. I would like to learn more, and what you shared with us is that learning is still so very possible.
Well, thank you so much, Geraldine. Thank you. And actually, I guess now I'm almost a neighbor of yours because I reload to the L.A. area. Oh, I don't know where Stockton is yet, though, but I'm learning how to become a Californian. That's on my list of things to learn this year, before the year is out.
Okay. Now, if I may cut in from the engineering booth, this is Beverly. And Stephen and Michelle, I want you to meet Geraldine Hollis. She is one of the Tougaloo Nine that integrated the library system in the sit-in in 1961 in Mississippi. So that is who Geraldine Hollis is. Okay, and I'm going to go back where I was.
Thank you. Well, much honor to you, Miss Geraldine. I appreciate all that you have done for us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm still a student of learning, and you never really get too old or too dim to learn. And I'm really keying in on the vernaculars and things like that that you're talking about right now. I'm true English, but even in reading certain books, it helps to know what the writer is expressing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think it's really challenging for the author, too, though, and you've written and published a book, so you can probably speak to this a little bit as well, but I think it's challenging for the author when you're working with an editor to say, hey, I don't want this to change. This needs to be this way. And so it's really important to me when I'm working with my authors that they feel like, well, what I'm giving you is a suggestion. This is not carved in stone. You're not required to take the changes that I'm making. This is what I advise based on what I've read and based on my knowledge, but you ultimately are the author. This is your story. This is your voice, and you have to tell it the way you and your characters require it. And so ultimately the final word is with you, and I think that that makes a difference in terms of telling your story. And I don't know how you found the editing process to go for you.
Well, I'll tell you exactly. I don't know how much time you have, but when I wrote my first book, I wrote it all out, and I sent it to my editor, and I'm like, okay, I'm finished. And she sent it back to me. She says, okay, those are the facts. Now write the story. Tell me how you feel.
Wow.
Tell me what you think. Tell me how you were mesmerized or afraid. Really give me all of those details. When you finish with that part and add it to what you've written, then you get back to me.
There you go. Well, and you know what she was really telling you was, it's time to do your rewrite. So that's what you call it. So a lot of that's actually good because it leads to a misconception a lot of folks have, and that is, okay, I've written my manuscript. Now it's done. Yay, ta-da. Well, it's not, unfortunately. That is just the first step in the process. Mm-hmm. The next step is really to rewrite the manuscript. And some of the most successful writers out there rewrite their manuscript 7, 10, 12 times. So, and that's a full rewrite. That's not just tweaking a word here and there. That's a full rewrite. And there are a lot of things that you can do to think about the rewrite process differently and how it can add nuance and depth to whatever it is that you're writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. So that's really where the hard work comes in, is in the rewrite process. And then it'll be ready to go to an editor after you've gone through that several times. So that's really what your editor was asking you to do, was that rewrite.
Well, I understood after that. My second book was really a lot different. I really did a lot more in involvement in the book itself. And when I did get it ready for print, I had reviewers to look at it, and it did I didn't have to have a lot of challenges and changes on it, but it was a good experience. So I will always remember that.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. That's really important because, you know, that's the only way that we'll know what happens and how people process. And I am a big proponent of telling your story. So I admire everyone who writes books and shares their stories with the rest of us because you're really opening yourself up emotionally and kind of laying yourself bare. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that response because that's exactly what it was. And a lot of times you don't realize, well, a lot of people may not realize how traumatic it is to really, when you're telling a story, and fiction is a bit different. I dabble in that just a tiny bit. But to tell a true story, you really have to open up and share things that you wouldn't necessarily talk about in person to someone.
Well, and then there's the adage that if it doesn't make you cry, it's not going to make anybody else cry. So if you shed some tears over your manuscript, you've done a good thing.
Mm. So there should be some tear stains on that manuscript, huh?
That's what they say.
Thank you so much, Miss Queen Stockton. Thank you for your contribution, your question, and your comment. You are very welcome. Now check in with one more caller. And caller, your exchange is 215. It's 215. So I just like your mic is now open. Do you have a question or a comment for Michelle? Hello, 215. Are you there? Going once? Going twice? All right. So, Michelle, we just have a couple of moments left, so now it is time for the Dirty Little Financial Secret.
Dirty Little Financial Secrets. Well, I actually have a couple of them.
Great, great, great. I got my pen and my...
Okay. So this is truly possibly because of my personality. So it may just be me, but I believe that it is better to not carry cash. And I know that may go contrary to what some other folks think. I've heard some people say it's a good idea to carry cash because it limits what you can spend. But the reason that I don't carry cash is I find that I don't remember what I do with cash. You know, once you break a 20, it's gone. Once you break a 50, it's gone. It's like, and you're like, hey, what happened to that 50 that I had in my wallet? It's just gone. So I tend to not carry cash. If I end up with cash, I tend to stash it away or I take it to the bank because I feel like it's better for me to be able to track my spending. And I can't do that as well with cash because I just don't remember. And that goes to my second financial secret, and that is to track every penny. And it might sound a little crazy and neurotic, but I may have mentioned I'm divorced. I have three kids, and things were tight sometimes. And the way that I found was best to kind of get a grip on what was going on with my money was to track essentially every dime that I spent. Whether it was a penny or, you know, $1,000, it didn't matter. I had to track it. And what that did was, and I use software to do this, of course, and what that did was it meant that I could look at, oh, wow, I'm spending this much on dining out every month, or I'm spending this much on, you know, tennis shoes or whatever it is, and I could figure out, well, where can I cut back here and how can I pay down debt there? It just gave me a really clear financial picture to use accounting software and really track my spending. And by using credit cards and debit cards instead of cash, preferably debit cards, I try to keep it to cash as much as possible. But it really helped. It really helped to kind of get things under control, especially right after the divorce when things were tighter.
Wow. Excellent. That's excellent. Is that it?
That's the two that I probably have a couple others if I thought about it, but those are the two that I thought were most important.
Well, I really appreciate that. I think that is powerful. Like you said, so your first one was better to not carry cash. It's a technique, as you're saying, and it's a technique that's working for you, you know, and you're saying, and the reason why you don't is because it's easier for you to track your money. Therefore, you prefer not to carry cash. And your other one is to track every penny that you spend. And because by tracking it, you are able to monitor it. And by monitoring it, you're able to control it. Right?
Exactly.
Now, just a quick question. And you also mentioned, so you prefer to use debit cards, of course, instead of credit cards.
Yes, whenever possible.
Right, whenever possible. And so what's your motivation behind using debit instead of credit?
Well, because you're using money instead of credit. I think that credit – so it's not to say I don't have any credit card debt. I have credit card debt. I try to use credit cards for big things, though, you know, or like for travel. When we get to a point – where we're using credit cards for groceries, we really have to think about what's going on. And there is a way to do it, okay? Let's say that you have gotten to a point where you have a certain amount of disposable income and you're using the credit card for groceries not because you don't have enough cash, but because you want to get your travel points or your cash back points or whatever it is that you get on that card, and you pay that card off each month. That's a smart way of using the credit card. And I don't mean to say another way is not a smart way, because we've all used credit cards all different kinds of ways. But what I have tried to start moving toward is not using credit cards for day-to-day stuff unless I'm going to pay it off. Oh, I'm going to the Nike store to get some tennis shoes for my son. Let's see if I can – and I have – this is another little dirty trick. I started buying gift cards on the discounted gift card site when I know I want to buy something at Nike or the Gap, whatever. Go buy the discounted gift cards. So you might get a $100 gift card for, let's say, $92. So you saved $8 there. And you know, if you buy that on your credit card, you get the cash back points. So you're getting cash back on your credit card, and then you go and buy the shoes, and hopefully they're also on sale, so you're saving money there. So there are a lot of ways that we can put these things together to save some money, but I think that we just have to be really a little wiser about how we use our credit cards. And I know that, again, divorced, I'm on my own, things happen, you have to run up credit sometimes, but that's one of the things that I work with in my own life to try and improve.
Wow, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. That's strategic movement right there. That is strategic, and that is required. I mean, I'm a firm believer in strategy. That strategy is required. Things don't just turn out good just because. There needs to be some intention for things to turn out right, and that's what a strategy is for. Now, my final question for you was if you don't mind, what kind of software do you use to keep track of your expenses? What software?
So on the personal side, I use Quicken Home and Business Finance. That's my personal tool of choice. And I've tried a lot of different software tools. Yeah, Quicken has its issues for folks who are like me. I'm actually on a Mac a lot of the time, and they don't have the home and business version for the Mac, so I have to keep that on a PC or use a VM or something like that, a Windows virtual machine, if I want to use Quicken, because it's basically – they have Mac versions, but not the version that I use typically. So, but Quicken is still my tool of choice. I've been using it for years and years and years, and I really like it. There are tons of tools out there, though, so even if you don't like Quicken, you know, there are tons of great tools out there. Now, on the business side, I use QuickBooks. I use QuickBooks Online. And part of the reason I use QuickBooks Online is because I'm familiar with it because I've used it in the past and because it's similar to Quicken in some ways. It was by the same company originally. And also, it's a really powerful tool. And because it's online, I can access it whether I'm on the Mac or the PC. And because I go back and forth between those platforms, I like to be able to access that information in both. And then also, if you are selling things, let's say that you sell books like I do. I may go to a live event and have books that I'm selling. You also have the ability to get the little credit card swiper, and I find that theirs is particularly good. It has a really good signal. But just for taking credit card payments, you don't need that kind of thing. You can get something else. But those are reasons I went with QuickBooks Online.
Excellent. Thank you so much for bringing it. I mean, you brought it. Ms. Michelle Barrard, you brought it. Believe me.
Well, thank you.
You brought it. Definitely be a very, very difficult show to follow, okay, to come because you cover so many bases. And so, you know, I mean, I feel like this is probably just like part one of what we can do. So you're always welcome back, and perhaps we could do this again sometime because I'm sure
that would be fabulous.
You know, on many things, we just scratched the surface. You know what I'm saying?
Well, thank you. That would be fabulous. I'd be delighted. And thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
And would you please give your contact information so that the listeners
sure.
can contact you?
Sure. So if anybody is looking to reach me, you can look for me online at Michelle Barrard, michellebarrard.com. That's the website. Or you can go to urbanbookeditor.com. You can contact me through either one of those websites. You can also find me on Instagram at Urban Book Editor, on Facebook as Urban Book Editor, and Twitter, Urban Book Editor. So you can find me in any
right.
of those places.
Wow. Thank you so much, Michelle. Really appreciate it tremendously. Great value, you know, and that's what I want to do on our show is to bring great value to people, and you definitely bring the value. So we will do this
thank
again.
You. Yay, thank
welcome.
You.
You are very welcome. So, everyone, thank you so much for your participation. And we had Miss Stockton who called in and made her contribution. So I'd like to thank everyone for coming. This is Stephen Hutchinson, your host of Financial Intelligence. I am also the tax ambassador for the Genius in Common movement. And I would also like to thank our sponsors. That would be the Tribe Family Channel, Ms. Beverly Black, as well as GeniusIsCommon.com. The founder is Bruce George. Thank you very much. We will be back. But in the meantime, take this financial intelligence and utilize it. Increase your financial intelligence and build, my people. Build.